Dear listeners, a quick note about today's episode. The events depicted are based on a real-life story, and we've used actors to reenact certain scenes. In most cases, we cannot be certain of exactly what was said, but all of our dramatizations are based on research.
It's a hot afternoon on Saturday, the 5th of June, 2010, in Nairobi, Kenya. Detective Richard Katola is driving to work. He's exhausted. He never expected his weekend to take such a drastic turn. Katola is a police officer and head of Kenya's Special Crimes Prevention Unit, and for the past 5 weeks, he has been working on a case that has taken a toll on him. It's the case of Anthony Mururi, a teenage boy who went missing back in April. Katola pulls into work, parks his car in the parking lot, grabs his briefcase from the back seat, and dashes out of the car. He enters his office building. The temperature in the building is a bit hot, and police officers in uniform are scattered around the building going about their normal day. Katola walks into his office, where he has files stacked up on his desk. He drops his briefcase on the table. The room is stuffy, and as he goes to open the window, there is a knock at his office door.
Come in.
Another police officer, Katola's partner, enters.
Katola, the forensic team is back with the results.
The officer hands Katola a file.
Is it a match?
Yes, the handwriting matches. He's our guy.
Let's go and talk to him.
Katola is happy they arrested the right guy. All he has to do now is to get the suspect to reveal where Anthony is. Anthony was kidnapped not too far from his home in Dagoretti, a suburb in Nairobi, the capital of Kenya. Katola and the boy's parents had spent weeks desperately searching for him, but they hadn't had any luck. 5 weeks after Anthony had gone missing, his parents had received a handwritten letter demanding 40,000 Kenyan shillings in ransom in exchange for his safe return. 40,000 Kenyan shillings is about 150,000 in Naira, or about $350. The ransom note instructed the money was to be wired using M-Pesa, a mobile money system used in Kenya. Katola and his team tracked the phone number where the money was transferred and arrested the owner of the phone number. The suspect they arrested is a man named Philip Onyancha. Katola and his partner leave his office and walk over to the interrogation room. The room is small with only four pieces of furniture. Three chairs and a big table are all in the middle of the room. The suspect, Philip Onyancha, a man in his early 30s, is seated in one chair across the table. His hands are cuffed together. Katola pulls up the chair to the right of Philip and sits. Without taking his eyes off Philip, Katola tosses the ransom note across the table.
We know you're the one. Where is the boy?
Philip doesn't look down at the note. He doesn't take his eyes off Katola.
He is dead.
That's not what Katola wants to hear. But he doesn't take his eyes off Philip. Philip keeps talking.
I killed him when I took him back in April.
Katola knows that Philip is not lying. The news is hard for him to hear, but he can't let Philip know how he feels. Katola grinds his teeth to hold back from doing something he will regret. He stands up, slowly preparing to leave the room. He has to deliver the news to Anthony's parents.
Wait, there is more.
Katola stops. He turns back to face Philip.
He is not the only person I killed.
What do you mean?
There are 18 others. I have killed 18 other people.
Hi, I'm Antonietta.
I'm John.
And I'm Nabila.
And this story...
This story...
could
save
your life. Philip is seated in handcuffs in a small room at the police station in Nairobi. Two people are in the room with him, Detective Katola and his partner, and Philip has just admitted to the officers that he is responsible for the deaths of 19 people.
These murders happened in very different places. How could you have possibly committed all of them.
Philip tells the officers he did.
I can take you to where I killed them. And I can show you the other bodies too. The ones you haven't found.
The detectives turn on the camera in the room and begin to record Philip's confessions. Philip begins his story in 2008 with a case of Catherine Chelangat.
I was a security guard at the local water utility office building in Karen.
Karen is a suburb in Nairobi. That night in Karen, it was nearly 9 p.m. and Philip decided he wanted to take a walk to stretch his legs. He wasn't the only one on duty, so he could spare some time away from his post. He walked to a nearby residential neighborhood, and it was there that he spotted a woman walking in his direction.
Something told me that the woman was lost. I didn't know who she was or where she was headed to. I had never met her before, but I was sure she would walk up to me.
Katola remembers the woman who went missing in Karen, a woman named Catherine Chelangat. Catherine had spent the day at her cousin's house and was on her way to another relative's place when she went missing.
The woman walked up to me. I shook her hand and she followed me.
What do you mean you shook her hand and she followed you? What did you tell her? How does a stranger start following you?
Katola doesn't take his eyes off Philip. He's analyzing Philip to see if he can detect any signs of insanity. 3 months after her disappearance, Catherine's family received a phone call from someone who claimed to have taken her. That person was Philip. He demanded a ransom of 30,000 shillings.
I had already killed her when I called to demand for the ransom.
If you didn't know who the woman was, then how did you know who to call to demand a ransom from?
I saw her on the news and recognized her. I needed some money and thought this was an opportunity to get some.
Katola can't believe what he's hearing. This was a case that had been open for about 2 years. The officers in Karen Police Station had been unable to find any leads to help solve the case of Catherine's disappearance. Yet, here is a man with all the details. But Philip is not done with his story. He starts to reveal details about a string of murders in Tikka that rocked the country over the last 6 months. Tikka is an industrial town about 65 minutes northeast of Nairobi. One of Philip's victims in Tikka was Jacqueline Wambui. The last time her family saw her was on a Sunday afternoon 6 months ago, back in January. Jacqueline told her mother that she was heading to Tikka in search of a job and that she would be gone for a few days. She hadn't been employed for a while, and her mother really hoped that this time she would get the job. Jacqueline had 2 children, and her mother didn't mind looking after the grandkids whenever Jacqueline needed to travel in search of work. Twiga Buildings is in the red light district of Tikka, and Jacqueline was one of the well-known sex workers who operated in the area. Her week was fully booked, but she was already looking forward to returning home to her kids. If her mother ever found out this was what she meant by searching for work, she would have a lot to answer for. One night during her stay in Tikka, Jacqueline walked into a room at the suitable lodging house, and there was Philip.
I left my wife and 2-year-old son in Nairobi earlier that day. I told them I would be back once work was done. It wasn't my first time in Tikka. In fact, I had been going to Suitable a lot around that time.
Philip pauses and has this faraway look in his eyes as if he is back in the room with Jacqueline. Katola's voice brings him back.
So what happened after you got to Suitable?
I went into the room, and there she was, the woman you called Jacqueline. And later that night, I watched as the police carried her body out.
Katola leans forward.
How did you kill her?
The same way I killed the 7 others. I had sex with each of them. Then I broke their necks.
Why did you go back to Suitable?
I went back a couple of times. Her naked body was still there the way I left it. I wanted to see if her body had been discovered.
Katola is still skeptical. These cases of Catherine and Jacqueline were highly publicized. A lot of people would have heard about the details, like the broken necks. It's possible that Philip is just telling them what he knows based on the media reports. Detective Katola has heard of people confessing falsely for crimes they don't commit for the sake of fame. And even though he's never seen that happen in his career, There's a first time for everything. Maybe this guy, Philip, wants publicity. Catola needs to know more.
Wait, you said the first time you killed was in 2008, right? How is it that you have been killing for this long and no one around has suspected a thing?
Well, back then, I was working as a security guard, so they all thought I was at work. The only person who became suspicious was my wife, but she thought I was having an affair.
Were all your victims outside of Nairobi?
No. I remember a boy. I think he might have been 9 years old.
The young boy was named Samuel Wanyonyi. It was June 2009, and Samuel had just moved to Nairobi to live with his aunt. He had been accepted to study in a school there. Samuel's aunt lived in the same neighborhood as Philip and his family. We don't know how Philip and Samuel met, but 3 months after Samuel's arrival in Nairobi, he went missing, and Philip organized the search party.
I organized a large number of volunteers who had gathered to find Samuel. I even led searches in different parts of the neighborhood.
Catola already knows what happens next, but he doesn't rush Philip. He wants to hear the details directly from him.
I waited a couple of days and then I wrote a ransom note, 40,000 shillings, and I gave them a phone number to send it through M-Pesa.
The family couldn't afford that much money, and they had already begun to suspect that Samuel was dead.
I waited a few more days again, and then I sent some of the boys' clothing to them. You know, as proof. I added another ransom note, this time asking for 10,000 shillings.
Despite the reduction, Samuel's family still couldn't afford the amount. While all this was happening, Philip was with the boys' family, trying to console them as much as he could.
I had seen the ransom note and I suggested to the family that maybe it was a woman who wrote it. That way, they couldn't suspect me, you know. And they never did. The boy was never found.
The interrogation is going into the third hour now. Philip has already revealed details into how he killed over 3 women and 2 children, and he still has more to say. In the middle of a story on how he killed another woman, Philip suddenly stops and tells the detectives something that sends chills down their spines.
I killed only 19 people, but my mission was to kill 100 women.
Catola can't believe what he's hearing, but he has to keep a straight face.
Why 100?
For the first time since the interrogation, Philip goes quiet. Catola leans in.
Why 100? How were you intending to kill 100?
The power of conviction.
What does that mean?
I have supernatural powers. I got them after I was initiated into the cult. All I have to do is to convince the women to touch my hand, and after that, they will be completely under my control. That's when I will lead the women to hidden locations and strangle them.
Catola suddenly begins to realize what he is dealing with. Philip is either mentally ill or a cultist.
What do you do after strangling them?
The blood.
The blood? What does that mean? What about the blood?
I will suck their blood after killing them.
At this point, Catola nods, gets up, and leaves the room. A few seconds later, his partner joins him outside.
Do you believe him?
Honestly, I don't know.
I mean, some of the people he's talking about, they're still missing, their bodies have not been discovered. But he could also just be making up everything in his head.
Let's go back inside. I have one more question for him.
They go back inside and Catola sits down again.
The cult. Tell me about the cult.
It happened in secondary school, about 20 years ago. My English teacher, Miss Elizabeth Wambui Kimani, she initiated me.
What do you mean she initiated you?
I used to sneak out of class and go to her house. I don't even remember why or how I would end up at her house. I will just be in class and then I will hear a voice telling me to go to the house. Somehow, I was always able to get to the house even though the school compound was guarded. I just felt like being with her all the time. We would sit around, talk, and drink alcohol. And I just kept going to Miss Elizabeth's house until the rumor started that dark things were happening there.
Wait, what do you mean by dark things?
I was initiated into a cult in that house. She made me take an oath that if I killed 100 women within 5 years, I would be made rich beyond my wildest dreams. We were into devil worshipping. It was a satanic cult, and I know because I used to have powers. Anytime I met a woman who shook my hand, she would be fully under my control.
Philip suddenly stops talking.
Go on. How did those powers work?
I can't say. I have said too much already. If I say more, I will lose all my powers and they will kill me.
It's at this point that Katola knows he has to find a way to prove if Philip is mentally ill or if he's telling the truth. And the only way to do that is to get him to show them where the bodies are. Over the next few weeks, Philip took Katola and his men to various locations where they found bodies that had been buried in places like a septic tank, the ceiling of a building, and even swampland. These were locations that were so remote that in some cases, there's no way Philip would have accidentally just come upon the bodies. But even though Philip showed them the locations of the bodies and his confession was videotaped, prosecuting him would be difficult without forensic evidence. Some of the bodies had been buried for at least 2 years, and so much evidence was lost. So far, Philip has been tried in court for a number of the murders, but he has not been convicted for any. The judges keep coming back to the issue of evidence. For example, one judge had to throw out one of the cases because the police failed to either collect or process evidence at the scene. There was a suicide note written on a wall in the room where the victim's body was found, but the police did not attempt to see if it was a match to Philip's handwriting. There was also blood at the scene that was not collected and analyzed. The videotaped confession was not allowed into evidence because according to Kenyan law, Philip should not have been handcuffed during the interrogation. And also, no one was in the room on Philip's behalf. To top it all off, he later ended up taking back his confessions and has pleaded not guilty to all the charges. So, without evidence and without the confessions, it is not clear if the police will be able to hold Philip on any of the remaining charges. We used several sources for this episode, including the videotaped interviews of Philip uploaded by KTN Kenya, unresolved.me, Citizen Digital, and The Standard. Join us next week for another episode of True Crime Niger. This time, we go to South Africa for the case of women who go missing while looking for work. True Crime Niger is a Triple E Media production. Production copyright 2021 Triple E Media Productions. This episode of True Crime Niger was written by Nabila Usman and John Iwodi. Produced by Antonietta Kalunta. Executive Producer Ramat Muhammad. Special thanks to Asogwa Chima Collins, Cune Austin, John Iwodi, Nabila Usman, Bright Oga Patrick, Dominic Tabakaji, Rabia Hadeja, and Sam Tabakaji. Stay alert, stay alive. See you next week.